For another take on recent developments in clinical research in lung cancer, I met with Dr. Primo Lara, who was also presenting at the Chemo Foundation meeting, and he began our conversation by commenting on a new class of agents being studied in the disease.
Vascular disrupting agents belong to a unique class of anti-cancer agents. They were designed specifically to destroy established blood vessels, which supply proliferating tumors. So, in contrast to angiogenesis inhibitors, vascular disrupting agents, which are also called VDAs for short, target established blood vessels. In contrast, you know, angiogenesis inhibitors such as bevacizumab or sunitinib target the neovasculature. So these are the new blood vessels supporting smaller solid tumors. So it's felt that VDAs are best used in larger solid tumors with established vasculature. And the mechanism of action is fairly unique. At first, if you hear about the mechanism of action, it sounds kind of scary, because what the VDAs do is cause occlusion of the blood vessels, causing hemorrhagic necrosis of the tumor. So basically, it's cutting off the nutrient supply of the established solid tumor by interfering with the established vasculature. So it will control cancer by inducing a central necrosis, and hopefully that will yield to better outcomes for patients.
What size blood vessels?
It's medium-sized blood vessels, the ones that are found in most solid tumors feeding the core, not the periphery.
It sounds like a really strange kind of mechanism. Do we know more about how it works? How did they even find out about this?
Well, you know, actually, they've been around for a while. The VDAs have been in development as far back as 1976. The NCI had this prototype. It was a small molecule, flavone acetic acid, which had vascular disrupting properties. And the agent I will be speaking on tomorrow was actually based on the prototype from the NCI. Now, the VDAs really are comprised of two general classes or subclasses. There are the so-called tubule binding VDAs and the flavonoids. The agent I'll be talking about tomorrow, ASA-404, belongs to the flavonoids. The tubule binding agents have been in development. You know, the other class, the tubule binding agents, have been available for a while. They've been in phase one and some in phase two development for the past, 10 years. You may have heard of cumbretastatin.
No.
Cumbretastatin A, that drug has been investigated for the past decade, and it still hasn't worked its way into a phase three trial because of toxicity. And as you would expect, vascular disrupting agents are kind of worrisome for causing vascular toxicity. And one of the main toxicities that were seen in early phase development was cardiac toxicity, particularly myocardial infarction and those sorts of vascular toxicity. It just so happens that this compound, ASA-404, this new flavonoid, appears to have a more favorable tolerability profile. It's a second-generation agent, small molecule, just delivered intravenously over 20 minutes once every 3 weeks, and appears to potentiate chemotherapy. And that's why it's being tested right now in a global study in non-small cell lung cancer.
What does it do to normal vessels?
Well, surprisingly, it appears to have, this is of course unknown function, appears to have specificity to tumor vasculature. In fact, that's what it's being bandied about as. It's a tumor-specific VDA. In phase one and phase two trials, no substantial toxicities in normal blood vessels were seen. Most of the effects were in tumor tissue. And this was actually borne out in the in vivo xenograft studies, that the vascular disruption appears to occur in the tumor cells. Now, we still don't know what the target molecule is of ASA-404. We don't know what it binds to on the cell surface. You know, so it's kind of unclear what the true target is. What we do know is that it acts directly on endothelial cells of tumor blood vessels, and it causes apoptosis of those cells. It also causes release of von Willebrand's factor, which leads to clotting and occlusion of the blood vessels. A secondary effect of it is that it triggers a local cascade of cytokines, principally serotonin and tumor necrosis factor, which potentiate the necrosis of the tumor mass and also potentiates the hypervascularity of the blood vessels and subsequent disruption of the endothelium.
It sounds like maybe you might see bleeding or abscess formation, or do you see any of that?
That was a pre-human trials concern, but those were not observed in the advanced non-small cell lung cancer phase 2 trial, nor in the ovarian and prostate studies where this drug was also tested.
Now, is this only given with chemotherapy or also as monotherapy?
No, it's only given with chemotherapy. You see, even in preclinical models, the efficacy of the single agent appears to be just, I would call it modest. It has very modest activity against xenografts as a single agent. Its best results were seen when it was combined with cytotoxics, especially the taxanes.
Anything you could tell us that would be encouraging in terms of what's been seen in humans in terms of efficacy?
The British Biotech, which had the agent for a while, pursued development in three tumor types based on the preclinical activity seen with the agent in combination with chemo. So those three tumor types were non-small cell lung cancer, ovarian cancer, and hormone refractory or castration-resistant prostate cancer. In the non-small cell lung cancer experience, what they did was take patients with previously untreated non-small cell lung cancer, metastatic, and put them through a randomized phase 2 trial. Arm A was chemotherapy consisting of paclitaxel and carboplatin, and arm B was the same chemotherapy plus ASA-404 given once every 3 weeks as a 20-minute infusion. Now, that was completed, in 2005, I believe, and the results were first reported at the triple meeting in 2006 by Joachim von Powell. In that trial, patients on the ASA-404 arm had a higher response rate. It was about 31% versus 22% in the control arm of chemotherapy alone. And amazingly, the median survival time of patients on the experimental triplet had a median survival time of 14 months versus just 8.8 months in the control arm. You see, 8.8 months is what you would expect with carboplatin and paclitaxel. So there appeared to be a survival benefit even in a randomized phase 2 trial, which, you know, led to some excitement.
How many patients was that?
It was a smallish trial. There were 32 patients in the experimental arm, a similar number in the control arm. Sometimes you'd say, this is hard to believe, so maybe this is just dumb luck. So what was actually done was a phase 2 extension was pursued. So this was a cohort of patients, another 30 or so patients were treated with paclitaxel and carboplatin, plus the agent, but at a slightly higher dose of 1,800 milligrams per meter squared. And in that phase 2 extension, with approximately 30 patients treated, the response rate again was 38%, as opposed to what was seen in the control arm of 22%. And the median survival time, again, in these 30 or so patients was 14.9 months. So it just sort of bolsters the concept that maybe vascular disruption is a rational anti-cancer strategy in non-small cell, because median survival time in these patients with advanced disease appeared to have improved or lengthened with the addition of this agent to chemotherapy.
Let's talk a little bit more about clinical research that's, you know, maybe a little bit closer to docs in practice. And I wonder if you could comment on the paper that you were part of, or editorial really, in the JCO in September, commenting on the issue of small cell cancer.
At ASCO this year, we had a series of presentations on small cell lung cancer. You see, the problem with small cell is we've not had any major advances in this disease for ages. It's sort of had a plateau in terms of efficacy in the past 20 years.
And you all pointed out in the editorial that it's kind of surprising in a way because it's pretty chemosensitive.
Correct. It is very chemosensitive. The problem with small cell, though, is it also, the disease itself, the tumor cells, quickly develop chemo resistance. And so even though they're initially chemosensitive, it just so happens that these tumor cells, because they have a unique biology, they have a lot of mutations that provide the cancer cell with the ability to become resistant fairly quickly. And that, unfortunately, is the downside of small cell. Anyway, so in this editorial, what we did was we reviewed the Hermes trial. So this was a Norwegian trial looking at carboplatin and irinotecan. And they were comparing that doublet to a control arm of etoposide plus carboplatin. Our own study in the Southwest Oncology Group, which we had submitted to the Journal of Clinical Oncology now for publication, and thankfully it's been accepted for publication there, is SWOG-0124. It's a randomized phase 3 trial of cisplatin irinotecan, that's the experimental arm, versus cisplatin etoposide, which has long been the SWOG standard arm. Now, this trial, the SWOG trial, was designed to validate the results of an earlier Japanese trial. This was the Japanese trial called JCOG 9511, which, as many of your listeners know, was highly touted. It was presented at ASCO and published in the New England Journal of Medicine because in that study, the experimental arm containing irinotecan improved survival as well as other efficacy parameters in Japanese patients with extensive stage small cell lung cancer. So we were really wanting to believe the results and wanted to validate it. And what we subsequently decided in SWOG was to duplicate the study, basically take the exact same treatment plan, dose modifications, eligibility criteria, and run it in a larger, more adequately powered study. You see, the Japanese trial was also underpowered because it had stopped accruing patients midway through accrual because the Data Safety Monitoring Committee noted the survival difference and asked the investigators to stop accrual. And they had a handful of patients in each arm, so it was really underpowered. And so SWOG did a study with 670 patients, this time to full power. And as we reported at ASCO, Dr. Ron Natali, my colleague, presented these results at ASCO. He described that the experimental arm in this trial with irinotecan did not improve response rate, progression-free survival, nor overall survival. So it failed to validate the Japanese experience.
So what's the bottom line when you put this all together?
Well, to put it all together, I think the winner at ASCO, if you put all the results of all the trials presented, which all had, in a way, an etoposide-containing control arm, the bottom line is that to this day, platinum plus etoposide remains the standard of care. In fact, that point is made more relevant by the study presented by Mark Sosinski, the so-called GALE study. That was one of the largest studies ever done in small cell lung cancer. So what they did was take patients with extensive stage small cell and randomize these patients to either etoposide carboplatin, so it was a carboplatin-based doublet, versus carboplatin plus pemetrexed. Now, pemetrexed is a multi-targeted anti-FOL, and there was a phase 2 trial that preceded this that appeared to show encouraging survival. So they went on and designed a study, which is a non-inferiority study, to see if pemetrexed carbo will someday, you know, be just as good as etoposide carbo. The trial was one of the biggest ever designed. They wanted to enroll 1,900 patients. At the interim analysis, though, they had about 900 patients at the interim, and they presented the results of the interim analysis at ASCO. And I think to those who went to ASCO, it was kind of a sobering result because what was reported was that the pemetrexed carboplatin arm was inferior to the control arm of etoposide carboplatin, and it was statistically inferior. The hazard for PFS was 1.79, and that was in favor of the control arm. So there were more patients who were progressing on the pemetrexed arm, and that wasn't the unkindest cut of all. You know, so when they drilled down to the other efficacy and toxicity parameters, response rate was also higher in the etoposide arm as compared to the pemetrexed arm. Progression was higher in the pemetrexed arm as compared to the etoposide arm. There were more early deaths in the pemetrexed arm, 16% versus 10%. So by all measures, it was the most negative trial that you could possibly have. And in retrospect, people have said that perhaps pemetrexed doesn't really seem to have a good rationale for use in small cell after all, principally because perhaps thymidylate synthesis levels are elevated in that disease and therefore make small cells relatively resistant to the effects of pemetrexed.
So we're still back 20, 30 years ago, right?
That's right, unfortunately. You know, but there are some positive things that I think we could look forward to because in the SWOG trial, what we did was collect genomic DNA from about 169 patients. We did that because one of our hypotheses leading into the SWOG trial was to evaluate whether pharmacogenomics will distinguish toxicity or efficacy profiles. You see, we felt that the Japanese experience may have been unique because it was done, well, in Japanese patients, right? And that's a very relatively homogeneous population. And you compare it to the North Americans, which is a, you know, melting pot, we felt that maybe the Japanese were seeing some benefits to irinotecan platinum because it was just a different population of patients. So what we did in our study was actually look at pharmacogenomics of particular genes relevant to metabolism and transport of irinotecan. And we did find a couple of polymorphisms that appeared to predict specific toxicities such as diarrhea, neutropenia, or both. And maybe the differences in those pharmacogenomic profiles is what explains why the Japanese trial was positive and the North American trial was stone cold negative. Now, having said that, the other explanation, which we said in our editorial for the Japanese trial being positive, was that it may have simply been what we call a random high in statistics, meaning when you have a small sample size, the likelihood of detecting a false positive result is substantial. And they may have detected a result due solely to chance alone. And it was really not a positive trial, but a chance finding, which happens when you have small sample sizes.
What about biologics and small cell?
Well, you know, that's also an area of very active investigation. Most of the biologics that have been tried in small cell have not yielded any substantial benefits. Angiogenesis inhibitors come to mind, and there was a study of bevacizumab with chemotherapy at randomized phase 2, which, at least to me, did not seem to add any substantial benefits to small cell lung cancer. The other class of drugs that I've personally tried in this disease are the proteasome inhibitors. We in SWOG did a large phase 2 trial, SWOG-0327, which took patients with extensive stage small cell who had failed prior platinum-based therapy and treated them with bortezomib or Velcade. Our rationale here was that bortezomib will help induce apoptosis in these cells and through the BCL2 pathway, and maybe we could win. You see, small cell has a high propensity for overexpressing the anti-apoptotic BCL2. So we did a study, fairly big study, about 80 patients, and the bottom line there is we did not see any substantial efficacy. The median survival time was almost 3 months.
Wow.
So it was fairly disappointing in this relapse refractory setting. And we saw a response in a patient with extensive stage refractory disease, but, you know, that was one response. And so it may, what we need to do is find what makes these refractory cells stick and then target them more specifically. Now, having said that, the new agents now that a lot of people are testing in small cell are the pro-apoptotic BCL2 targeting agents. And there's a whole bunch of those now, small molecules that belong to a drug class called BH3 mimetics. And there's some preclinical promise that those are the agents that may finally address the BCL2 mechanism in small cell and maybe improve outcomes. There's another chemotherapeutic agent in development. It's called amrubicin. It's an anthracycline. And in Japan, again, this came from Japan. Most of the phase 1 and 2 trials came from Japan. Amrubicin appears to have remarkable benefit to Japanese patients with relapsed or refractory small cell lung cancer. They had high response rates, but the Japanese experienced a lot of toxicity, particularly hematologic toxicity. They had problems with profound neutropenia in the vast majority of patients receiving amrubicin. Having said that, the high response rates in the refractory setting sort of make you pine for additional studies with the drug. And so that's being investigated now in the U.S. by a couple of investigators.
Let's talk a little bit about non-small cell. I wanted to ask you about the paper you were part of at ASCO. It seemed pretty innovative, looking at intermittent erlotinib combined with pemetrexed.
Sure. And, you know, that's really an offshoot of a hypothesis that was generated out of UC Davis with my colleagues, David Gandara and Angela Davies. The hypothesis here was that the concurrent use of EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitors, such as erlotinib and gefitinib, with chemotherapy is antagonistic. We, I think, can fairly, you know, back that up, because there have been now 4 large randomized trials of chemotherapy with or without either erlotinib or gefitinib. We've all seen those papers and we all shed a tear because all 4 of those trials showed absolutely no benefit for the combination of chemo plus an EGFR inhibitor. And the hypothesis here was that the TKI probably leads to some form of growth arrest in the cancer cells.
Sort of like the old hormonal therapy plus chemo and breast cancer?
Absolutely. In fact, it is directly related to that, I believe. You know, so this actually speaks to Kathy Albane's report on tamoxifen plus chemotherapy. I think it's the same rationale. And therefore, if you put these cells in cell cycle arrest, the efficacy of chemo is reduced because especially taxanes, right, which are most active in the M phase of the cell cycle. So what we've hypothesized at UC Davis was perhaps we can still use these agents together, but you have to separate them in time and space. The so-called pharmacodynamic separation strategy, where we provide these agents intermittently. Now, the trial that you speak of at ASCO, which was pemetrexed plus erlotinib, was really the second of a series of trials that we've done with this concept, where we did a trial with docetaxel.
Right, and you presented that at ASCO too, right?
That's right. Dr. Davies presented that on our behalf. And right now in the Southwest Oncology Group, I'm chairing a study in non-small cell lung cancer patients with stage 4 disease and performance status 2. We're taking these patients, doing a proteomic profile that will predict benefit from EGFR inhibitors, and more on that later, but a proteomic signature from their serum. And we're taking these PS2 patients and treating them with either single agent erlotinib or pharmacodynamic separated chemo plus erlotinib. We were going to use this trial to see if pharmacodynamic separation would yield superior outcomes to single-agent erlotinib in a patient population that we think would benefit most from an EGFR TKI. So, you know, pharmacodynamic separation needs to be tested in more advanced trials. I think what we've done at UC Davis was pilot the concept with docetaxel and more recently pemetrexed, but it needs continued research to validate those observations.
So what's the exact schedule? How do you do this?
Well, you know, it's different. What we do is we give to the listeners, I think what they would need to do is not do this, you know,
at home.
Because this is investigational. But in broad terms, what we do is we give the chemotherapy and we provide the erlotinib separated from chemotherapy maybe 1 or 2 days after the chemotherapy is given. So it's separated. And then the next dose of chemotherapy has to be given after the erlotinib has washed out. So we stop the erlotinib a few days before the next cycle, so that they're never together. They're never given together.
How many days of the erlotinib did they get? And what's the half-life of erlotinib?
Erlotinib is taken daily, so the half-life is short. It's about a day, I believe. And so it doesn't take too long before you could start chemotherapy.
So what have you seen so far clinically?
Well, actually, the results have been remarkable. You know, we've been surprised because what we've seen in the UC Davis trials was that the combination of docetaxel plus erlotinib appears to improve, at least based on our historical controls, the progression-free and overall survival of patients in the second-line setting, as we had presented at ASCO.
You also mentioned a proteomic assay looking, I think I heard you say, in terms of predicting response to EGFR TKIs?
That's right. You know, so
what are you seeing? What is it and what are you seeing?
So it's a proprietary technology that one of my colleagues, Fred Hirsch, had worked on. Fred Hirsch is at the University of Colorado. And what he and his colleagues did was took the serum of patients who were receiving gefitinib from Italian patients, as well as a few sera from Japanese patients receiving gefitinib, and designed a study looking at a proteomic profile. Now, they're using MALDI-TOF. And to your listeners, that's MALDI is a technology that stands for matrix-assisted laser desorption ionization, and TOF is time of flight, and it's a kind of mass spectrometry. And what Dr. Hirsch and his colleagues did was identify a particular proteomic profile, so certain peaks on the mass spec that appeared to predict an improved time to progression and survival under the influence of an EGFR TKI. And those results had been published, and not what we're doing is taking that same technology, because as you know, it's easier to get serum than it is to biopsy tumor tissue. And we'd like to test that proteomic profile in a prospective manner rather than a retrospective manner to see if the observations that he saw in this retrospective analysis are true.
So is there an overlap between, for example, I mean, what fraction of the patients have a, quote, positive proteomic profile?
Oh, that's also the good thing about this profile, because about over half the patients will have a positive profile, so a little over half. So that makes it a lot more user-friendly than in North America particularly than, for example, mutations, right? You know, where the mutation rate of EGFR is far lower.
So what's the overlap between this assay and FISH and mutations?
Now, that's unknown. You know, so we will be investigating that in the SWOG trial that I described earlier in PS2 patients, because in that trial, we're going to use the serum proteomics as our discriminant to get into the study and take in those patients who are registered tumor tissue to look at FISH and mutations and to see how this overlaps with those other means of interrogating the EGFR status.
Let's talk a little bit more about the issue of tissue predictors in non-small cell in general.
I'd like to actually back off a little bit and talk a little bit about the ESMO presentation by Tony Mok. You know, he presented the IPASS trial.
Right.
Because that probably reminds us that we are now in the era of personalized medicine. You see, in the IPASS trial, patients with advanced non-small cell lung cancer, mostly East Asian, in fact, they're all East Asian, were randomized to receive either gefitinib or IRESSA versus carboplatin and paclitaxel. So it's a frontline trial of EGFR TKI versus chemotherapy. What was unique about IPASS was that they only registered patients with adenocarcinoma, never or light smokers, or light ex-smokers, and never smokers were defined as less than 100 cigarettes in a lifetime. In fact, the vast majority of patients registered in this trial were never smokers. And like I said earlier, these are all East Asian. So as you could see, these were a highly, highly selected group of patients, selected for the likelihood of possessing an EGFR mutation. And there's a large trial, 600 patients in each arm. And when it was reported at ESMO this year by Tony, the hazard ratio for the primary endpoint of PFS was 0.74. The p-value was highly statistically significant. So there was a 26% reduction in the risk of progression during the course of the trial in favor of gefitinib, which was remarkable. And when they did the subset analyses, they found that mutations were found, not surprisingly, in 59% of the patients. Why not, right? They were East Asian women, adenocarcinoma, never smokers. And when they looked at the subsets, those who are EGFR mutation positive, it told us an important lesson that those patients who were EGFR positive, mutation positive, appeared to benefit from frontline IRESSA compared to chemotherapy. In that population, the hazard was 0.48. That was remarkable. In contrast, if the patients were EGFR mutation negative, so even though they were women, East Asian, never smokers, but they were EGFR mutation negative, it was the opposite. They did not benefit from gefitinib. In fact, their PFS was one of the worst. The progression-free survival curve was heading straight down. And in that particular subset, it was chemotherapy that was the winner. So in that comparator, the hazard ratio was 2.85, highly statistically significant, and it was not favorable towards gefitinib. So it is telling us that the mutation status does probably predict improved outcomes to an EGFR TKI, in this case, versus chemotherapy. I think FISH is probably going to emerge as one of the predictors as well. It's already emerged in SWOG because Dr. Hirsch and Dr. Roy Herbst did a study with David Gandara looking at cetuximab. So not just TKIs, now an EGFR monoclonal antibody. So it's a randomized phase 2 trial of chemotherapy concurrent with cetuximab or chemotherapy followed by cetuximab in a sequential manner. And in that experiment, patients who were positive for FISH for EGFR appeared to have better outcomes as compared to those who were FISH negative. And that translated to a better PFS and better overall survival for patients who are FISH positive.
And you're saying greater benefit from the cetuximab?
We can't say that for certain because both arms received cetuximab, you see. So there was no non-cetuximab arm. So the true test of whether FISH will be validated in the setting is going to be asked in a phase 3 trial that's going forward within the Southwest Oncology Group. This is a trial of chemotherapy plus cetuximab versus chemotherapy alone. And in that trial, we'll also take patients who are bevacizumab eligible and allow them to receive chemo, carboplatin paclitaxel, plus bevacizumab with or without cetuximab. Now, that large randomized trial will take patients with advanced non-small cell lung cancer and take their tumor tissue, and then, like I said earlier, they will now validate whether FISH truly predicts outcomes under the influence of cetuximab, because now we have a control arm that does not contain cetuximab.
I was kind of surprised at that study in terms of the combination of those two agents in view of the notable lack of success in colon cancer.
Correct. In fact, it hasn't yet been reported. It will be at the upcoming Chicago meeting, but SWOG actually piloted the combination of chemo, bevacizumab, and cetuximab. It's been piloted in SWOG in a phase 2 trial, and the results haven't been presented, so I have to keep my mouth shut. But when it's presented in Chicago, you will see that the results gave us the highest median survival we've seen in this population in SWOG. So in this phase 2 of this 4-drug regimen in a pilot phase 2, we did not see any antagonism between the 4 agents as was seen in colorectal carcinoma. So I think what we're trying to say here is probably colon cancer is not the same as lung cancer. And in fact, one line of research that sort of helps bolster this is RAS mutations. In colorectal cancer, everybody knows that RAS mutations predict little benefit from cetuximab, while wild-type tumors probably will benefit from the drug. Well, in lung cancer, that actually hasn't been quite shown yet. Some preliminary data done in SWOG doesn't seem to show any, looking at KRAS mutations and cetuximab in SWOG, it doesn't seem to show the same downside that was seen in colon cancer. So there's some talk about the fact that all KRAS mutations are not equal, that the KRAS mutants in colon cancer are different from what we see in lung. And there's some precedence to that. For example, c-KIT mutations, right, in GI stromal tumors. These tumors respond wonderfully to imatinib. But in small cell lung cancer, which has a lot of c-KIT and c-KIT mutations and all that jazz, the use of imatinib is of very little efficacy. It's because the same mutations that you see in GIST don't exist in small cell, even though it's the same gene, c-KIT. So there's more to the story, and I think it just needs to unfold, and we need to do more research on the role of KRAS in predicting outcome to cetuximab therapy in lung cancer. That's still a long ways going.
Speaking of that, what were your thoughts about the FLEX trial that was presented at ASCO and the other data that we have about cetuximab and non-small cell?
Well, you know, the FLEX trial was a large phase 3 trial, one of the largest done. And it was a trial of cisplatin, vinorelbine, with or without cetuximab. And it was the true first test of whether cetuximab will improve outcomes in non-small cell. And indeed, it did improve outcomes. The hazard ratio for survival for the experimental arm in that study was 0.87. So it was quite marginal, you know, modest at best. And if you look at the median survival times, it was even more modest. It was barely a month difference at the median. What was interesting about that trial was that when they looked at the ethnic groups who were enrolled, it was the Caucasian subset that appeared to benefit the most from cetuximab therapy. So in the subset of patients with lung cancer who received cetuximab, the median survival time was 10.5 months. In those receiving chemotherapy alone, it was 9.1 months. The hazard there was 0.8. So it was a 20% reduction in the risk of death in Caucasians. In contrast, the Asian subgroup in that trial appeared to not benefit from cetuximab. The hazard ratio there was 1.179. And so it was a wash in the Asians. And what was interesting, though, was that the median survival time of Asians was incredibly high. You know, it was 17 months in the experimental arm, 20 months in the control arm. You know, I'd be dancing the jig if our North American patients achieved median survival times exceeding 14 months in a randomized phase 3 trial. But they appeared to be doing that routinely in Asia, but not in the U.S. So what are my thoughts about that trial? Well, I think it confirms that cetuximab does have clinical activity in lung cancer, particularly advanced non-small cell lung cancer. However, there is some dampening of my enthusiasm with cetuximab plus chemotherapy. One, the survival benefit is admittedly very modest for the general population. There was a high rate of febrile neutropenia, and as you recall, it exceeded 20% in the experimental arm, in the cetuximab arm. And I think that borders on an unacceptable range of febrile neutropenia. Third, you have to factor in the inconvenience of weekly intravenous therapy with cetuximab, because it's given, you know, IV weekly, and that is quite a challenge for many patients, particularly those who live far away from their treating physician's offices. And then I'm also a little wary about why the trial was positive for overall survival, but had no difference in terms of progression-free survival. In fact, they were virtually the same number, right? And so PFS benefit did not seem to be observed in the cetuximab arm, and that's really unexplained. And to this day, I could not explain why progression-free survival was not improved, because they usually go together, PFS and overall survival. And the fifth point that dampens my enthusiasm is the high cost of therapy with adding this biologic agent to chemotherapy for the modest survival benefit you see. And at some point, we as a society need to evaluate whether we can all afford this, adding these biologics for what appears to be modest benefits. Having said that, what I think FLEX did for all of us, and you've already alluded to this, Neil, is that it highlights the critical need for all of us in academia and perhaps even in industry to identify and validate better predictive markers or biomarkers for cetuximab benefit. Because if the overall population only benefits marginally, then maybe we should do trials with a more selected population and make that hazard ratio a little bit more attractive. One more point to make about FLEX. It is a trial that did try in many ways to choose patients more likely to benefit. Remember, in that trial, they allowed only patients who had EGFR positivity by immunohistochemistry in at least one tumor cell. One. So that was a very liberal definition of IHC positivity by EGFR, but it was done. And amazingly, even though it was a liberal definition of EGFR positivity, only 85% of patients met that criterion. So 15% of patients absolutely did not have even one single cell positive for EGFR by IHC. Now, that tells you something. Had they included those patients in this trial in an unselected manner, I suspect that the hazard ratio might have been closer to one, right? It may not have even become a positive trial because those EGFR IHC negative patients would have contaminated the results. So the FLEX trial was positive in some part probably because they selected those who had at least one tumor cell positive for EGFR. We still need better biomarkers than that, though. And that's where EGFR by FISH will come in, and maybe KRAS mutations. We need to see that in future trials.
What about predictors of response to BEV?
Now, that's a pet peeve of mine, and it's not just with BEV. And you see, Neil, I also treat patients with kidney cancer. I'm also a genitourinary oncologist. I chair the Kidney Cancer Committee, Advanced Kidney Cancer Committee in the Southwest Oncology Group. And one of my frustrations is that we are using these targeted therapies, specifically the anti-angiogenic agents, in an untargeted manner. You know, so we all call them targeted therapies, but we're not really selecting which patients have the target and which ones will benefit most from our therapies. Are there predictors of benefit with bevacizumab? Sadly, the answer to that right now is no. People have looked at the most likely biomarker, which is circulating VEGF levels. maybe even circulating VEGF receptors. But to date, none of the circulating secreted biomarkers have been shown to be predictive of outcome. Yes, they've been shown to be prognostic, but none have been predictive of benefit to bevacizumab. So the work continues, and I think we just need to work harder, because what this means is that patients, their oncologists, need to participate in these validation trials, submit tumor tissue, submit blood, you know, patient specimens, so that we can interrogate these tissues and find a biomarker.
What do you think about the issue of looking at Bev in the adjuvant setting? There's a big ECOG trial out there right now looking at that. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, that big adjuvant trial is an intergroup effort. You know, most of the cooperative groups have thrown their hat into the ring. They're taking patients with selected 1B and early stage completely resected disease, stage 2 and early 3, and randomizing these patients to chemotherapy, which is a form of dealer's choice chemotherapy. There are several platinum doublets that are thrown in there with or without bevacizumab. And it's now really asking the question of whether angiogenesis inhibition in the adjuvant setting will improve outcomes. And it's accruing nicely nationally, but, you know, it will take a while for us to see those results. And I think we all need to support that trial. So to all the listeners who do have that trial or have access to that trial, I encourage you to put all your patients with completely resected disease onto that study. Now, as a tangent to that question, at ASCO this year, we heard the updated results of the International Adjuvant Lung Trial, or the YALT trial, which was fascinating to me because, as you all recall, the YALT trial was presented with great fanfare at ASCO in the plenary session, because it was the first large adjuvant trial in non-small cell lung cancer showing a survival benefit. It was a small benefit, but positive nevertheless. And when it was presented, the hazard ratio for overall survival in the YALT when originally presented was 0.86, and the p-value there was around 0.03. What was interesting at ASCO this year was that those results were updated with a long-term follow-up. And in the new update, that survival advantage had now disappeared. So the hazard ratio was now 0.91. The p-value, no longer statistically significant, p was 0.10. So this is kind of an interesting observation, because typically you'd like to see survival benefit from adjuvant therapy persist throughout the course of the follow-up period, but in this case, the survival curves came together. And the YALT investigators looked at certain subsets just to interrogate this further. They found that the distant metastasis rate was still better in patients receiving adjuvant chemotherapy. It was statistically significant. The curves were different. 0.02 was the p-value. So it wasn't the distant metastasis rate that was different. In fact, chemotherapy prevented the recurrence in distant metastatic sites. When they looked at second malignancies, there was no difference. So chemotherapy did not increase the rate of second malignancies past 5 years of follow-up. What they found to be mostly contributing to this reversal of fortunes was the increase in the non-lung cancer mortality in patients who had received adjuvant chemotherapy. The hazard ratio there was 1.34. The p-value was 0.06, but, you know, I think that's what explained why the overall survival curves came together. There were more patients dying of non-lung cancer causes who had received adjuvant chemotherapy as opposed to those who were observed.
Do you think that was a real finding or just maybe statistical play and just like, you know, that comorbidities and other causes of death just sort of dampened it out in general?
You're probably right, Neil. It could be a statistical play or a statistical chance. But I wish to point out that when you look at survivorship studies in patients who had received platinum etoposide, for example, which is the principal chemotherapy in the YALT trial, and those survivorship studies were mostly done in testicular cancer patients, where cisplatin etoposide is standard of care. So in survivorship studies, there is a high rate of cardiovascular disease, as well as infections and other comorbidities in patients who had received this platinum based chemotherapeutic regimen. So I don't think this is unique to just lung cancer. It's been seen in long-term follow-up studies in testicular cancer. So there's something there. Chemotherapy does something that increases the risk of late cardiovascular events. And I don't know what that is, but it does so in testicular cancer. And that's probably what's also happening in these patients who are already predisposed to cardiovascular disease. They're smokers, they have COPD, and they have other factors that will make them at risk for non-lung cancer mortality. So that was an interesting sidelight. And what I think people should take away from that is not stop giving adjuvant chemotherapy. I think what it showed us was that the efficacy of adjuvant chemotherapy, at least in the YALT experience, appears to be confined to the first 5 years after surgery. And there's some diminished benefit after 5 years because of unexplained treatment-related mortality. And what this behooves us to do is continue following up the other adjuvant lung cancer studies and not, you know, fall asleep at the wheel. We need to wait for the long-term results of all the other adjuvant studies that have ever been done and to see if this is a universal finding. Because if it isn't, then maybe this is just another, like you said, a statistical fluke and may not actually apply to the rest of the other trials.
Anything you want to add to what you said tonight?
I think there's now a lot of interest in ERCC1, which is kind of amusing because ERCC1 has been interrogated forever. You know, it's not a new gene. And ERCC1, as you know, is involved in DNA repair. It's an excision repair gene. And it's an interesting gene because high levels of ERCC1 are prognostically good, right? Because if you have high levels of a repair gene and its repair enzyme protein, then you'd be able to cut out all of these adducts that attack your DNA, and you'll probably have a better outcome because of that. So it's prognostically a positive thing to have, high ERCC1. The problem is ERCC1 is also responsible for DNA repair of platinum adducts. So if you treat a tumor with platinum and you have high levels of ERCC1, well, that tumor will more readily repair the platinum adduct and the tumor cell survives the platinum therapy. So high ERCC1 is a poor predictive marker for platinum therapy. So it plays dual roles, right? It's a good prognostic marker, but it's also a poor predictive marker for platinum therapy. And so the YALT trial, which is the adjuvant cisplatin versus no such therapy lung cancer trial, was analyzed. The results were published in the New England Journal of Medicine, where they looked at the tumor tissue of patients. And basically, ERCC1, as we posited, appears to have prognostic value, like we said, and it confirmed our suspicions. It did predict that patients with very high levels of ERCC1 did not benefit from platinum-based chemotherapy. So seeing all these pretty, I think, in my mind, reliable information on the role of ERCC1, it makes sense scientifically. It made sense when they analyzed this in translational studies. These biomarkers are now being used in a prospective manner to help select the chemotherapy for patients being treated with adjuvant chemotherapy. So, for example, there's a SWOG trial where they're taking early-stage disease and resecting these, and if they have high levels of ERCC1, they'll be treated with one regimen, and those with low levels will go on and receive their platinum-based chemotherapy.